Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo, and the team from The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we'll be taking a fresh look at inclusive leadership. I am delighted to welcome Gary Brown to the podcast to share his thoughts, knowledge, and expertise. Welcome, Gary.
Thanks, James. Good to be here.
Gary, I really appreciate you taking some time out to join us today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Gary Brown. I am the Head of Learning and Development at Nestlé UK and Ireland. I've been doing that role for, I suppose, about nearly four years now. And my background really is I have been at Nestlé for quite a long time. It's actually my 25th year next year. But the majority of my career actually I spent in operations, in supply chain. So I've got a slightly different background maybe to your typical HR or L&D person. So that's kind of a little bit about who I am. I would say that a few years ago I moved into a developmental space because I was really aware that what motivates me and drives me actually is people development, and in particular human behavior. Like, why do we do what we do, and how does that impact our behavior in the workplace? And I suppose in particular around that, how behavior drives performance, really. So that's a potted history, I would say, James, in terms of who I am and what I do.
Fabulous. And I know you're joining us today to share some thoughts you've sort of generated through some of your studies and some of the research you've done. So do you want to share a little bit more about what you've been researching and what that's led you to consider and find out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, So I've been doing some research as part of my master's program around inclusive leadership. And this is a topic that I've been really interested in and doing some work internally in my day job, if you want to call it that. And so part of my role really is about developing the leaders within our organization. And the idea of and the kind of growth of research around areas like inclusive leadership and psychological safety in particular, I think are really interesting. So my research kind of centers around that stuff. And the reason that's kind of important, I think, is that, the big picture, if you like, is that the world is, changing so fast. Everybody knows that. And it's not going to slow down in any kind of way or sense anytime soon. So the concept that, leaders are heroic figures who know everything is such an outdated notion that I think that the growth of concepts like inclusive leadership behaviors and psychological safety are really about how do leaders develop the right capabilities and skills to get the best out of teams, and in particular diverse groups of teams. Because I think the other strand of research that plays into this is that idea of cognitive diversity, i.e. the teams with the broadest perspectives and lived experiences and bring more to the table. They have more raw material to innovate with. But you only make the best out of that raw material if you've got the right environments, which is where things like psychological safety and stuff come into it. So I think that this area has grown a lot and is, I would sort of describe it as coming into the mainstream of business now as some of these concepts are starting to be well understood. And the links even between if a leader displays inclusive leadership behaviours, they'll grow psychological safety, and teams with higher psychological safety outperform other teams. I think those kind of links are actually very well established now. I think what's probably a little bit less understood the gap in the research that I was looking at was, surprisingly, in amongst all of that stuff, there isn't really a lot of research that sort of points to the fact or explores whether being an inclusive leader is easier if you are like me. So what I mean by that is, you will see a lot of the research talking about the fact that leading groups of people that are diverse is actually harder right? And that makes logical sense because, you know, people are different perspectives, you know. But there isn't a lot of actual research that will talk about that particular thing about if you're like me in my team, I actually find it easier to connect with you, to be inclusive towards you, etc. So that was really the kind of gap, if you like, that I was interested in. And like, you know, just maybe to kind of pull out a little bit of some of the things of why is that interesting? Like the there's a thing called homophily, which is like one of the most well studied and robustly studied human phenomenon. And basically it's about the tendency of all of us as humans to gravitate towards people that are like us. So it's an incredibly human trait. And really what I was interested in is if we know that inclusive leadership behaviors lead to greater psychological safety, and we also know that higher degrees of psychological safety drive performance, then what's the impact of exploring if your team is like me, is it easier to be an inclusive leader? That's really the kind of gap that I was interested in terms of the study, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a really interesting area, and, you know, talking about that homophily and, yeah, but we gravitate towards people who are like us. I think there's lots of terms you've used in there that are clearly very relevant and known by some people. But as you said, this is coming into the mainstream. So we may have listeners who've heard these terms, maybe people who use these terms and maybe don't really understand them as well. So I just want to unpick some of those things that you've talked about. So
sure.
Let's start with, you know, whether it's inclusive leadership or psychological safety, because those can mean very different things to very different people and in very different organizations. And, you know, I've seen sometimes, you know, it becomes a bit of a fad of, oh, we'll just do inclusive leadership without understanding what that means. So do you want to give us a bit of a dive into what those concepts mean, and then we can move on to some of the rest.
I mean, I think if we let's start with some definitions. I mean, if we think about inclusive leadership, you know, there's lots of different literature out there, but the best, I would say, research out there would really define inclusive leadership as having two big component parts to it. The first is valuing difference. So, you know, do I really value what difference brings to the team? Okay, which starts to kind of play to that homophily challenge, let's say. And the second is the ability to foster belonging. So what that really means is my behaviors as a leader, they actually encourage people to feel that they are connected to the team and that they belong in the team. So valuing difference and fostering belonging, they're really the two big component parts of inclusive leadership. And you can probably start to see the connections, I think, when we start to define psychological safety, because, you know, psychological safety, if we picked out, I don't know, two of the biggest researchers and all of their work around it, Amy Edmondson would be, you know, the one that's probably most famous associated to psychological safety. And she would define it as something along the lines of, you know, feeling safe to speak up without fear of retribution, right? So feeling that I can offer my opinion without fear of comeback or retribution or being, you know, derided in any way, that kind of thing. And the other person I'd probably point to in this arena is a guy called Dr. Tim Clark. And he has done some really cool work in psychological safety, taking it a step further, in my opinion, anyway. He outlines the four stages of psychological safety. And his definition of psychological safety, I think, is pretty interesting, because he calls it an environment of rewarded vulnerability, right? Which basically means, you know, it's an environment where if I like engage in a vulnerable act, I'm going to be rewarded for it, right? So what does he mean by vulnerable acts? Well, you know, asking a question is a vulnerable act, right? Because I don't quite know the answer. I'm putting myself out there, you know, making a contribution, giving a different point of view, you know, challenging the status quo, right? That's a vulnerable act, right? So the point is it's an environment of rewarded vulnerability. You're really encouraging people to do that, and that's really what a psychologically safe environment is about. And just to kind of outline his four stages, what he talks about is that to have a psychologically safe environment, you need to feel included. That's the first stage. So if you don't feel included, you know, you're kind of out of the game in the first instance. You then progress on to learner safety, which is where you start to feel safe to actually engage in learning acts, you know, clarifying things, questions, etc. You then move on to contributor safety, which is where you feel, now I feel really safe that I can offer my point of view and perspective, etc. And then the kind of culminating stage, which is where he talks about it, you really get into the innovation space, is challenger safety. So that means you really can, you know, offer a different point of view. So that's, you know, there's loads of depth underneath that, James. You know, like, his work is so good. I would absolutely encourage people to look at that. But I think if with those definitions of inclusive leadership and psychological safety, I think hopefully people can see the connection there, because what you're saying is my behavior as a leader, if I'm inclusive, I'm illustrating that I'm valuing difference. And I'm encouraging people, you know, to feel that they belong. And your kind of output, if you like, is levels of psychological safety, because people are engaging in those vulnerable acts in that environment. They're feeling safe to kind of have their voice out there, question and challenge. And that's obviously what drives performance, right? Because it's the challenge of the status quo that drives innovation, as an example.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I'm just reflecting back as you're speaking, some of the businesses and organizations I've been in the past. And, you know, I'd see almost pockets in some organizations that are probably the antithesis of everything you've said. But there's maybe a leader in there who's fostering that environment despite everything going on around them. And then conversely, there's, you know, you can have that leader who's creating something. Again, you know, you might have inclusive leadership generally across an organization, but one individual is creating that environment which doesn't have those behaviors. And you get all sorts of different things across the piece there. And I know certainly in times in my career, I found the only people who could speak out in certain environments were the ones who didn't worry about being safe, who didn't really want to belong, because you had to be the outsider and you had to not worry about your job and everything else, because it was, you know, that was how things got broken, but, you know, and changed because someone had to speak up. But the people who fitted in were the people who conformed and were like everyone else. So it's a really, you know, I'm fascinated to know where your research has taken you, because I can see, you know, just from you introducing it, some of the themes and questions I'd be wanting to dig under and understand more of.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, even though we've laid it out in, you know, I know they're quite detailed, but that they are quite clear terms, right? You know, I think the thing we have to be really cognizant of is this is not easy, right? What we're really talking about is that, you know, me as a leader, my individual behavior, right? And there are so many things that play into that, right? How I feel about the role that I'm in, you know, have I got inner imposter syndrome, you know, all of these things play into that, because but in the end it plays out in terms of my behavior to other people. And like, you know, I often, when I kind of get into these sorts of discussions with people and some of the leadership programs we run, you know, people have so many different takes on leadership, right? My honest opinion is that if you boil it down to its kind of essence, you know, what is leadership, right? It's influence and impact on other people. And that happens through your behavior, right? So the reason I kind of personally gravitate so much towards inclusive leadership as a concept is that I think, again, in the world that we work in today, you know, this idea that you need to value difference, you know, and that in itself is hard, right? Because it's easier to work with people that are like you. Just back to that homophily point that we made earlier on. Yeah, and it's actually what we seek as humans, right? So if you know, it's a well studied social phenomenon, because we all like want to be part of a tribe, we all want to be in the in group, and then we gravitate towards people. So valuing difference in itself is quite challenging for leaders, I think, because it infers that you want to bring in people that are not going to agree with you, which is a challenge, right, for leaders. So you've got to be open to that is the first point. And I think the second element of it, of the fostering belonging bit, that's challenging too, because again, it's easier to foster a sense of belonging if everybody's like you. You know, if you like football, right, and everybody in your team likes football, brilliant, you've got something to talk about, right? But imagine the one person who doesn't like football, right? How are they feeling when everybody's kind of chatting about, you know, the games at the weekend or whatever? You know, they're probably not getting to the first stage of psychological safety because they don't feel included. So my point here really, James, is that I think even before we move on to some of the nuances about difference and stuff in teams, I think leaders have really got to think about their behavior. And certainly some of the work that we've been starting to do beyond the kind of concept bit is to really think about how that plays out in everyday moments. Because what we're really talking about here is, like, you know, how I interact with people, you know, and there are moments that matter, right? So like when I have my check-ins with my people that I might have every month or week or however leaders do it with their people, like, what's the tone of conversation that I'm using? You know, how much am I talking versus allowing them to speak? What's my coaching skills like? Some of it is kind of, you know, not new stuff, classic leadership, but I think the inclusive leadership concept really makes you think about your behavior in those key moments, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think it's really nicely set the scene in terms of, you know, huge levels of complexity, but you can walk those through and give that personal ownership back to behavior. And there is something that we can own and do something about. So let's come back to your research. So do you want to sort of give us, you know, obviously you're interested in this area. This is, you know, through your master's, you've led into this research. Do you want to give us a bit more context to what you're looking at and how you were looking at that?
Yeah. So kind of, with all of that having set the scene, you know, this interesting link between inclusive leadership and psychological safety, again, back to the kind of gap that I was interested in, this, you know, how can you really explore the idea of homophily, you know, that kind of concept of, like, if you're like me, you know, is it easier to be an inclusive leader? So that was kind of one of my hypotheses going into it, basically, right? So how do you prove that? So what I did is I looked at, it was a quantitative study. So basically what that means is we did a survey with a whole bunch of people, did it with around about, I think it was about 350 people in the end, something like that, across certainly my network. So a lot of it was internal in my company, but also external. So we did some of it with other organizations too. And what we asked them to do was actually fill in a questionnaire reflecting on themselves in terms of how they feel about the inclusive leadership behaviors of their direct line manager and how they feel in terms of psychological safety. And then we also captured how different they perceived their line manager to be. So what I mean by that is in the survey, there were categories of difference. So, for example, my line manager is a different gender to me. They're more than 20 years older than me. I perceive them to have a different religious perspective or ethnicity. So what we were doing is really exploring, you know, what were the different characteristics between that relationship between the individual and their line manager, if that makes sense. And I should say that, like, the questionnaire was based on well-used, robustly defined scales by experts that have already been established. So that was all good from my perspective. That was great because they already existed. So basically, by capturing all of that, what you're able to then do is start to do some interesting correlation work about, you know, what are the patterns that you see within that. And the first thing really to establish was that everything that we've just discussed, you know, that idea that if you have inclusive leadership behaviors, if you display inclusive leadership behaviors, it will lead to increased psychological safety. That was hypothesis one, right? So you've got to establish that first of all before you do anything. And I'm pleased to say that that was very, very clear. So what we saw when I'd done the analysis around that was there was a very strong correlation between experience of inclusive leadership behaviors and how people feel from a psychological safety point of view. And then the next thing then was, if we've established that, it was really to understand, okay, so what is that impact of difference? So I looked at this in a couple of different ways. So the first thing I did was we kind of split the groups and said, okay, so those that said there were no difference between me and my line manager, and those that said there was some form of difference, do we see a difference in terms of the correlation of the scores, right? And the answer to that was also a very positive, resounding yes, in the sense that we could see that those that had said that they were the same in effect as their line manager, very, you know, similar people, experienced both increased inclusive leadership and increased psychological safety compared to those who said there was some form of difference. So now that we've established that, you know, there is a difference between those categories of people that think they are very similar to their line manager, and those that think there are differences that exist, the next thing was to kind of go a step further and actually examine if we started to look at, well, how many levels of difference actually start to make to create a picture of impact, let's say. So really what we're exploring in here is the concept of intersectionality. So to bring in another kind of, you know, researchy term, let's put it that way, intersectionality is really a construct that is about exploring how differences interact with each other and create, you know, even more marginalization for people, right? That's a term that the intersectionality was, a term that was kind of born out of social justice movements and stuff like that, and really, again, is a term that I think people will see coming into diversity and inclusion work more commonly too. The principle here is that actually, when we start to think about diverse groups of people, we don't just want to categorize people as one thing, right? Because nobody's one thing. We're all a multiple of things, right? So we're not just a gender, we're not just an ethnicity, we're not just, but what intersectionality promotes is the idea that multiple levels of difference can compound marginalization, because people get, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 times over marginalized, right? That's the idea behind it. So mm-hmm. what it's promoting is the idea to think about diversity more in a respecting everybody's individual circumstances rather than just categorizing people, if that makes sense. So to bring it back to the study, the idea here was that intersectionality, the hypothesis, if you like, actually magnifies the difference that we see. So what we did in this part of the study, I looked at three groups of people this time. So what we did is we said, okay, so if we've got one group, which is I'm very similar to my line manager, then I've got a second group, which is there's one level of difference between myself and my line manager. And then there's a third group, which kind of represents intersectionality in a really, really simple way. This group is people that said there's more than two levels of difference between myself and my line manager. And then we explored feelings of psychological safety and inclusive leadership in those three groups. And lo and behold, what I saw was that the first group, where the similarity exists, obviously saw the highest levels of those two things. The second group, there was a dip, but they were, so if there was one level of difference, there was a slight level of, there was less in terms of inclusive leadership and psychological safety, but the intersectionality group had a much lower level of psychological safety and inclusive leadership. So the point of the study was, what it was showing was that when we actually test those hypotheses, what it suggests is that the impact of difference between line manager and individual is actually very big. So what it suggests is that idea that, you know, I gravitate towards people, that whole homophily phenomenon does exist in line manager and employee relationships, right? And that actually aligns very well to some of the literature around and studies around homophily, because to be really practical about it, there's one I remember in this one that I came across where they talked about a study of people joining organizations and about how they were more productive if they've like early on, if they felt that the people that they were working with were like them, right? And if you just think about that for a minute, they were more productive. What that suggests is that they were less scared, right? They felt kind of like they naturally belonged straight away. So if that individual was different, you know, the flip side of that is they're less productive, right? Now, that's because they don't feel they belong. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do something about it. What it should be suggesting to line managers in particular is that when you've got a new person joining your organization, back to that value difference point, what are you doing to go out of your way to make that individual welcome and help to foster that feeling of belonging, if you see what I mean? So if we really bring it back to the everyday behaviors, what it should be promoting is that idea that you have to respect everybody's individual circumstances and really kind of help them be very proactive in terms of how you help them to feel that they belong. Because that is, as I said earlier on, the first stage of that whole psychological safety phenomenon, right? They've got to feel included and that they belong in the organization.
It's interesting because you're talking about those multifaceted things just between an individual and a line manager. And then you're overlaying team dynamics in there as well, you know, so
100%.
Yeah, you know, hugely complex. And, you know, it's almost, as you said, I see me being similar to my line manager, similar to my teammates or whatever it happens to be. I see one level of difference. And then, you know, my brain's spinning off. Are there particular types of difference that lead to more levels of not feeling included or not, you know? So, you know, you can start spinning and then thinking, well, actually, as soon as I start seeing one or more, what's happening to the individual, what's happening to the manager? Yeah. Is it about, you know, confidence and again, so I'm just spinning, so there's loads of stuff spinning around in my head, which I'm sure is why you're interested in this, but it's
yeah. I think that's right, James. I mean, you know, even in what I've described, you know, the structure of my study for, you know, this master's program was relatively simple, right? So we're talking about some pretty complex topics and, you know, constructs and theories and whatever. But what I tested for was relatively simple. So what I mean by that is we're just really teasing out in a really simple perceived way, which is an important point as well, perceived difference. Because the perceived word is interesting as well, right? Because it's like, well, I perceive that they're different from me, not like I actually know, right? And the whole point was really to kind of illustrate, you know, through proper and quantitative methods that this is a thing, right? There is an impact here. I think to your point, James, you know, what you do with that information is you bring it back to everyday behaviors. And you bring it back to valuing difference, and you bring it back to, if I'm a line manager, particularly even if I'm a line manager that really buys into and supports everything associated to diversity, equity and inclusion, right? You know, what we should also be thinking about is not categorizing people and it just as a label, their gender. I need to have more women in my team, right? You know, I need to have more ethnically diverse people. It's not really about that. It's about individuality, right? And everybody's individual lived experience is different. And I suppose if there was one thing from a very personal perspective out of this study, you know, that I could convey, it would be that I would urge line managers to really think like that, you know, actually think about an individual as an individual with an individual set of lived circumstances, not, you know, a category or whatever. And to bring that back to performance, which is the bit I said at the beginning that really interests me, is like how this behavior stuff plays out in performance. You know, the work of like Matthew Syed is great, right? So he's got a book called Rebel Ideas, which is awesome, right? I would tell everybody to read that book. But really what he talks about in that is this phenomenon of cognitive diversity, right? So the point is with that is you need to have people that think differently in a team, right? Now, thinking differently is often informed by people's lived experiences. So it does mean, you know, people with from diverse lived experiences. But the reason I say that is that, you know, let's take an example. If you had, I don't know, a bunch of people with very different ethnic characteristics in a team, right? On the face of it, that would suggest that's a diverse team. But what if they all went to the same school and they all went to the same uni and they all had the same, you know, then, and I know that's an extreme example, but my point is, it's not always going to give you, you know, cognitive diversity in a team. So again, the point of this kind of study is really to kind of get line managers to be thinking about individuality. How well do I know, you know, the individuals in my team, what they bring to the table really through their lived experiences, because it's uncovering their unique strengths, if you see what I mean, and giving them a voice in the team. That's really what kind of drives the performance angle of diversity through all of these things that we've talked about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, you made that point, but it's a really important one, that people are not their labels, and those labels are not what you see. So, you know, what you see is not what you get. What's first presented is not what you get, etc. So it's, and I'm like you, one of those people who's really interested in people. So I want to find out people's stories. I want to find out more about them, what makes them tick, what they've been and experienced that I can learn from, you know. And in some ways it's a selfish thing for me, that I want to learn and know as much as I can, and I can't do that all myself. So speaking to people from different backgrounds, and, you know, I've seen studies in the past about, you know, people's social circles and how homogenous those are. And you know, one of my reflections on what we've been through in the past few years is that, you know, we got locked away in our own little circles. We spend less time outside of our circles, commuting, going into the workplace, spending time across a broader range of an organization, just because we're not in that space. We tend to be doing one-on-one interactions more, you know, in desk-bound jobs, of course. Again, people's lived experiences. People think everyone had the same lived experience of lockdown or COVID. You know, it's the same thing. You know, and it's having that understanding and that empathy and seeking to try and understand and explore and create that opportunity for people to speak rather than assume. And I think there's a whole load of behaviours there around just curiosity that almost underpin a lot of these things, because you can't just assume or look. And again, I've seen this a lot in the leadership stuff I've done earlier in my career, about people are not really interested in anyone else. There's a lot of people who are just interested in validating their opinion or listening to respond. And again, it comes down to the same issue to me, that we've got to have those underpinning behaviours, as you've talked about, that show, and they're not necessarily to do overtly with inclusive leadership. They're just to do with good interpersonal skills and building those in.
I would agree with you. I mean, I think you mentioned two, you know, behavioral things that are super important in this, which is, you know, empathy and curiosity, you said. And that's actually, we use that a lot in the work that I do internally around inclusive leadership, because they are, they're, and courage is probably another one that I would say in there as well, because I think that they are, this stuff is not easy. I'll say it again, you know, I said it earlier on in our conversation, it's not easy, you know, and a lot of what we're describing here is, it links to, you know, leadership concepts that have been in leadership development forever and a day, things like emotional intelligence and self-awareness, right? That they are the cornerstones of becoming a leader. So, you know, anybody who is a leader knows that they went through a transition from leading themselves, and it was all about them and it was all fine because they knew what they could do, towards then having to leading other people. And it is, it's, you know, in my opinion, one of the, probably the biggest transition you have to make, because you have to start employing, you have to start being aware of your own impact, and you have to start employing emotional intelligence in a way that's going to, you're going to be a bit more skillful in the way that you interact with yourself. It's not about changing you as an individual, but it is about knowing your preferences and how you show up to people and impact other people, because as I say, in my opinion, leadership is all about influence, and you're influencing people all the time, whether that's the people in your team, whether that's the people above you or stakeholders or whatever. So I guess bringing it back to kind of the conversation around inclusive leadership, these things are quite important in the world that we work in now, because, you know, the other thing that's really interesting in this space to me is that, you know, diversity is a fact. You cannot run away from it, right? The workforce is becoming more and more diverse. You know, it's a fact of life. And if we're going to work in places that reflect the societies that we live within, then we have to develop the leadership skills that are going to help diverse people to thrive, right, in environments. And that's really what this whole topic is about, is it's not necessarily, to your point, James, I think some of this stuff is not necessarily brand new leadership stuff, but it probably has got a slightly different perspective, right? Which is about, you know, how do you really help diverse groups of people to thrive? But not just so it's a lovely working environment, so that there's performance at the end of it, right? So that there's innovation, so that there's, you know, businesses thrive too, if you see what I mean. Because the flip side of it is, by the way, if you have a big drive on diversity and representation, but you don't do anything about helping leaders to develop inclusive leadership skills, then that's actually the worst place to be. You're going to go backwards is what's going to happen in that scenario.
Yeah, I think you need that skill set to be able to manage that cognitive diversity, to bring that to be positive and not just conflicting and divisive in terms of how that works. So I think that, you know, there's huge amounts of skills for leaders in looking at any team that they're managing. So one thing on your research, so you went in with a set of hypotheses and you seem to have proved those hypotheses. Did anything Indeed. Surprise you, or, you know, what else did you learn through the study that, you know, is an area you want to go differently or look at?
So the three hypotheses that were, if I can even say that word, hypotheses that were lined up, they were indeed all proved, and they were kind of really informed by the body of literature. So when you do one of these things, obviously, you kind of, the literature review really informs your hypotheses, and then you test them, right? So the reassuring thing there is that all of the literature that's out there, you know, it really gives me confidence that the conversation we're having today is, you know, fully grounded in scientific, well-researched content. Was there anything that we didn't, that I found that I was surprised about? Yeah, there was one little thing actually where when I sliced the data, one of the ways I looked at it was I looked at the difference between those that said they were the same and those that had one level of difference. And I did a particular cut of data where I looked at that from a female perspective, right? And what it didn't show was a statistically significant difference between the group of people that said that they were the same and a small subset of the data that showed a gender difference, right? Now, it part of the reason it might not have been statistically significant is because we were starting to get down into kind of really small numbers. So that's part of the problem. But the thing that didn't kind of ring true to me in my head is that, you know, we often hear that, and there is lots of, again, research around this, that the women being managed by men sometimes creates you know, a different experience, let's put it that way, in terms of psychological safety and inclusive leadership, that none of that showed up really in the data that I had. So just to be really clear, what I mean by that is we couldn't really see a gender impact, if you like, for women having a lesser experience when reporting to men, if that makes sense. But I do think that might have been to do with the subset of the data not being big enough. But that's probably the only thing that I was surprised by, James, that we didn't really see in the data that gender difference coming through.
And did you see anything, just, you know, traditionally it's been, you know, glass ceiling for women, ethnic minorities, etc., getting through an organisation. Did you see anything the other way around in terms of you know, women managing men? I'm, you know, just interested as...
No, else. I mean, and in fairness, I didn't cut the data in that level of detail. I think in the kind of recommendations for future research, what I talked about was the fact that it would be interesting to do more study work on identified intersecting groups, by which I mean, you know, we might look at, I don't know, ethnically diverse females and their experience of inclusive leadership and psychological safety, and what you might do that would be more interesting actually to build on what this study was showing is do some qualitative work. So rather than just, so what I've done is quantitative, so it's correlation work, right? But actually you could take a group like that who are living at the intersections, right? So they're female and they're ethnically diverse. What is their experience, and do that in a more qualitative way? So, you know, some of the things you're getting at are like exactly right, I think, James, but that we couldn't see that in this, in the scope of this study. That would be where you'd go next. The idea would really be to explore, you know, those intersecting lived experiences within an organization, and do that, because what intersectionality is really saying is that you have to be careful about how power and systems work in organizations to create doubly oppressed intersections, if that makes sense. So kind of really examining the lived experiences of those intersecting groups is really one of the recommendations, really, to kind of go next with this sort of thing.
And you've touched on it with the sorts of things you could be doing in organizations and where these things could be a risk or not. But if you're sort of taking that step back and saying, from what you know now and validating, you know, and reassuring yourself that a lot of the research out there is true and based in sound science, etc., what would you be saying to people they should be doing differently or thinking about in their organizations?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things, I think, at different levels, actually. So at an organizational level, one of the really interesting things is there's some studies out there about the maturity journey around diversity, equity and inclusion in organizations. And at one point, there is a phase where some organizations have reached the level of maturity in the sense that they've got things like employee resource groups, right, or networks. So they've got networks around gender, ethnicity, disability, neurodiversity, whatever it may be. But actually, in that maturity journey, sometimes what happens is they unintentionally compete against each other. So, you know, and that might be driven by forces within the organization. Like, as an example, there might just be one budget, for example, for all of those resource groups. So what can happen is they reach a stage where kind of unintentionally they're competing against each other, like maybe for that budget, for example. So at an organizational level, even just starting to talk about the idea of intersectionality, you know, is a good thing to do, because what it starts to do is strip away some of that, you know, unintended consequence of competing against each other by actually kind of recognizing everybody's unique differences. Because not only, you know, are you in this category, but you might be in this one too. As we said earlier on, we all have, you know, multiple categories, if you want to call it that, that we live within, or sections. So that's kind of an organizational level, which sounds kind of simple, right? But and it is kind of simple, but really having that conversation so that you're promoting the idea of uniqueness, valuing uniqueness, as we said, in terms of inclusive leadership rather than categorization is one thing that can help. I think we've kind of touched on this, but at the leader level, you know, certainly what the route that we're taking around inclusive leadership in my day job work, if you want to put it like that, is first of all, like, raising the understanding of some of the things we've talked about today. So what does inclusive leadership mean? What does psychological safety mean? How do those things interact? So a lot of what we kind of talked about today. But also, I think most importantly, this idea of bringing it back to the moments that matter. So, you know, this is all very, for some people, this would be like, man, this is a bit, you know, ethereal and a bit theoretical. And I totally get that. But actually what we can do is bring this right back down to our day-to-day interactions with people. You know, to what level am I really thinking about my behavior as a leader and the impact that I'm having on another individual? And particularly if that individual is very different to me. That's the whole point, right? If they have a very different view of the world, a different set of lived experiences, am I really, to use your word, curious and employing empathy to really understand their, because that's how you develop, you know, and foster those feelings of belonging, which is stepping into, I'm starting to feel psychologically safe, and I'll progress through those stages that we were talking about earlier on to kind of really thrive ultimately in the team that I'm in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And the bit that always fascinates me as well is the organization structures and culture that sit around this, because sometimes the people can almost change their behavior, but everything else lags behind, or those things are pushing you back. Because, you know, you've talked about managing someone who's very different. Lots of the structures of organizations will never create that situation in the first place. And so there are, you know, almost huge constraints or legacy systems, or, you know, inbuilt legacy ways of thinking that we don't even perceive. And that might be, you know, just how the employers perceive that we would need to tap into some of those groups.
That's exactly right, James. And I do think it's important with this stuff to I think sometimes, certainly in an organizational setting, I work in a big organization, you kind of hear this stuff and you go, yeah, that makes sense. And then you kind of like get a bit overwhelmed. Where do you start, sort of thing? So I think it's important to recognize that all of this stuff is about taking small steps and making progress over time. I think that's really important so people don't feel overwhelmed. But just to pick up on your point there, you know, the way that I would kind of play that back, what you said is it's almost like there are systemic forces, right, that sometimes are at play when we're all trying to do the right thing. But, you know, there are certain things, certain processes that kind of are not very inclusive that then create a bad outcome, if you see what I mean. So if we took an example, I'd say a moment that really matters as a line manager is when you recruit. So how inclusive are your recruitment practices today would be a very tangible question you can start to ask of yourself and of the organization that you work within, right? Because, you know, if we want to talk about building more diverse organizations, and then the very route where we bring people into the organization does not have practices that, you know, allow for that and promote that, well, you know, then obviously we're shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit. So I guess my point here is that I think with this understanding of inclusive leadership, you can start to really apply that to those key points and key moments in the map, and you will uncover stuff, I'm sure, that is systemically a challenge. You know, I could go on about this for it, but if your organization does calibration of any form, you know, around your performance ratings or your talent processes, well, what's going on then? You know, what's this check around bias, for example, that is being, you know, naturally, because we're all humans, and if you're human, you are biased. But what's in place there to try and make sure that calibration, for example, is done in the most inclusive way, if that makes sense? So it kind of uncovers loads of questions, right? But that's good, because it gives you something to work with. And to my point, you clearly can't necessarily do everything overnight. But I think that's the point, is we're trying to provoke a different discussion about how you bring about more inclusive cultures ultimately, but you have to really focus on leadership behavior and day-to-day leadership behavior as a not the only start point, but a massive part of the equation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was alluding, as some of my experiences have been really in that recruitment space, where I've seen processes that were put into promote opportunity and diversity actually achieve exactly the opposite, because they're actually almost homogenous, because they're overly fair and the criteria are set, and they're, you know, but they then just bake in that predefined way of not opening up what we're looking for. And I love the point you made about, you know, you have to get creative as to how you can do calibration in a more inclusive way. And I think it's having that belief and want to do things in a more inclusive way, and then thinking about how you do those things inclusively. And that's not going into a room and locking yourself away. That's opening up the process and seeking feedback and seeking different opinions. And that's where the, you know, the power of cognitive diversity comes in, because getting more people in, you're going to get a different solution, maybe not a better solution, but you're going to get a different solution. Sure. And you're going to learn and iterate. And I think it's those things that, you know, maybe people can be picking up, because otherwise we just roll out the same old things. And when we're going to make very, very incremental change in stuff because of that mothership of the forces that are holding us to, you know,
equilibrium. And that's it, James. I'll say it again, probably the third time, this stuff is not easy, right? Yeah. I think what we're doing here is often, you know, challenging things or turning over stones of things that have maybe been the same in organizations for a long time. And so I think it is important that we're all realistic about that. But these are the right things to do. You will not, you know, you can either, to pick up on what you're saying, that evokes an image of like glacial change, right? You know, oh, maybe we'll nudge forward a little bit in 5 years. Whereas actually, I think, you know, really leaning into the concept of inclusive leadership is more provocative, and it creates, when you really understand it and you really get into the kind of the behavior on a day-to-day basis and the people processes that we follow, inclusive leadership, I think, can really help you to challenge some of those big things that can actually make a massive difference over time in the organization. But it requires courage, it requires curiosity, it requires empathy, all the things that we were talking about earlier on. So not easy, but for me, you know, it's why I find it so fascinating. I think it's a real opportunity to create both fairer and equitable workplaces, but ones that drive performance too. That's what I think's most interesting about it.
Yeah, and you know, it is a fascinating subject. You know, you've said that, and I totally agree. And we could go in all sorts of different directions. I'd love to ask you loads more questions, but given where you are, what's next for you in terms of your research or your thinking or areas of interest for you?
So two things. I mean, I think internally in my day job work, we're doing a lot of this stuff at the moment. I would say that in my organization, we're at the stage where we've done quite a lot of sharing of some of these concepts and a bit of upskilling of starting to help some of our leaders and our broader organization understand some of the concepts, but it takes time. We're really trying to focus on bringing that into these everyday moments that matter, the, you know, the key interactions that we have, so it's really tangible for people. So very practically, that means for us that we're, you know, we're really working hard on what are the kind of, you know, interventions and support and stuff like that we currently do around the whole area of leadership, and how do we bring these concepts really into those interactions. So a real focus on baking in all things inclusive leadership and psychological safety into the work that we do to support our leaders. That's the first thing. And I think for me personally, I've really enjoyed the research. I'm actually looking to publish the study. So I'm going to focus on that in towards the back end of this year, hopefully. And then I'm interested in kind of some of the areas that I talked about in terms of the next iteration of study, or what you might do with it, the recommendations. So I'm hoping that maybe over the next couple of years that I'll do a few more studies in this field, but maybe a little bit more focused on some of those areas of intersectionality and lived experiences in organizations, because I think there's some interesting things that I think we could discover in there about how people experience organizations when they live at those intersections, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes lots of sense, and like you said, there's lots of areas and fascinating bits to look at as you go forward. So if people have been inspired, intrigued or energized by anything they've heard today and want to pick up, follow you, find out when your research comes out, what's the best way of them getting in contact?
Yeah, or... I mean, probably LinkedIn, I'd say. That's the easiest thing. I'm on LinkedIn, reasonably active. If people are interested in the work that we're doing, I'm always happy to talk to people in this space because it's I find it very interesting, and it's great to hear what other organizations are doing too. You know, it's like James, you know, when it sometimes you like to know that you're not on your own with this kind of stuff, right? So if other people are kind of thinking about things in this space and look at attacking it slightly differently, yeah, great to connect and talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people sharing those experiences, good, bad and indifferent along the journey, absolutely, all different views and perspectives, things they've tried, research that other people may have undertaken. So, you know, thank you very much for joining us today. What we will do is make sure all of those contact details, so your LinkedIn is in the show notes below. We'll also put some of the links maybe to the books you've mentioned as well, because I think you've mentioned quite a few useful resources for people who, you know, may want to, you know, tap into some other resources, sure, yeah, etc. But yeah, Gary, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, James. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if The Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.